Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta, entitled The Palace Undergrounds. The talk is delivered by architect Edward Side.
Well, good evening. Thank you for coming this evening. The first little announcement, because the president had to attend about 6 months ago, told me definitely I will come for the undergrounds. I don't know if I went down under there, because but that's a nice place. But in any case, but I told me, sorry, I've got a very important book launch and I can't make it today. So we thank him for giving us the opportunity to hold these lectures here, but unfortunately I had not come. So, thank you again for coming this evening. This is the second lecture in this second series, because at first there were those who told me, Salvatore, the subject is saturated, but as you can see, and as you have seen, the last lecture and the oncoming ones, not yet saturated, the aspect, the historical, architecture and whatever aspect of this palace. So this evening we have our dear friend Edward Said, who immediately told me, yes, of course, about, or why not, I'll do the lecture. Well, one has to understand the undergrounds are not a very nice place. In fact, he just opened his heart for me this evening at Salvador. I don't think I carry on down under, because I have seen so many things. The most recent one, better not tell you what it was, because I was terrified. But apart from that, so we admire him for his courage to undergo such a... In fact, also, another point, I was very pleased when he told me about 6 months ago that about 5 or 6 years ago, I delivered the first, not to be proud of it, up to a certain extent, because I used to do lectures for the Lord Halua, and always rediscovering Valletta it was, and one of them was Valletta Sotterranea, underground Valletta. It was packed up, the house there of the knights, people even sitting on the floor, and I didn't know that Edward Said on that occasion attended, and he said, you sort of inspired me to go underground and see what's down below, in any case. So let's see what Edward has in store for us this evening.
Thank you, Salvatore. Thank you for the invitation. I accepted the invitation because it would have given me an opportunity to go down for the third time below the President's Palace. My research involved mainly Valletta as a whole. There have been not many occasions where I focused on one building, and by no means have I gone into much detail with this building. And I think amongst us tonight there are people who probably are more of an authority on, definitely on the construction and the way the President's Palace developed over these centuries. So please feel free to pitch in with any anecdotes, comments, or any information you might have which is relevant to what I'll be going through. The way I've gone about this is basically a run-through of things I came across when I was doing my research on Valletta as a whole. Obviously, the Magisterial Palace is a key building. It always was. But unlike many of the other important buildings in Valletta, such as the Co-Cathedral, the Auberges, the Sacra Infirmeria, the Armory, and so on, the President's Palace, then known as the Magisterial Palace, started in an unusual way, if you like. It was not meant to be here. Now, I'm going to assume that Nobody really knows about this, so I might be repeating information which I'm sure some of you, many of you know about. When you look at the President's Palace today, at first it looks like a symmetrical building, very homogeneous, very unified, but this was the result of quite a few interventions in order to make a building which was not initially one building, but three, come together as what we see today. And numerous Grand Masters contributed to this. Now, I am not going to go through the construction of the President's Palace, because that's a subject for another lecture. I think it was given in the past, right, Salvatore? No doubt it will be given in future. There are a number, there's one very good paper, which I know about, by Judge Giovanni Bonello. And obviously, by seeing the way the building developed, one can reflect all of this into what one encounters below ground. And interestingly, from an archaeological point of view, if you like, down there is a timeline, which might not be so obvious today. One of the first representations of Valletta, pretty much complete, was drawn during Grandmaster Wynyacourt's time. And if you look at the palace, let's just go back again, you'll see Piazza San Giorgio, as it was known then. So this is Wynyacourt's time before the introduction of the aqueduct, because as you know, he built the celebratory fountain at the center of Piazza San Giorgio. But you can see that the elevation here on Palace Square is disjointed. In fact, originally this was, as I said, a number of houses, a number of buildings, four to be precise. There was the original Auberge of Italy here, which was a one-story building, very much like Auberge d'Aragon is today. I would say practically all of the auberges in Valletta, except the Auberge of Aragon, were significantly changed over time, particularly in the Baroque period. The Auberge of Aragon, if you remove the neoclassical portico, is very much how Girolamo Cassar left it. And Girolamo Cassar was, in fact, the architect of the Auberge of Italy. The magisterial palace was earmarked for Castile. In fact, South Street was at first, the late 1560s, known as Strada del Palazzo, because the palace was going to be sited up there, probably because the location is so prominent. However, Grand Master Del Monte changed his mind almost immediately, and he took up residence in a house which had been built on this corner by his nephew, Eustachio Del Monte, who died soon after it was built, and his uncle, Grand Master Del Monte, took over. In between, there was also another house belonging to two knights whose surname was Bozio, and the Grand Master acquired them and immediately pressured the Italian knights to find other lodgings, because he said he was convinced that this would be the best site. It's interesting to read that Bartolomeo Genga, or Genja, or Genga, had, before the Great Siege, when Valletta was earmarked for when Shibaras was earmarked for the construction of a new city, had proposed that the magisterial palace be sited exactly in the center of the Via Decumanus, which was Strada San Giorgio. So this idea had been mooted much earlier. Anyway, and the result was a rather misshapen building, which is quite, unexpected for one of the most important structures in the city. But then, over time, things changed. A survey dating to 1633 shows how this aspect remained so until, much of it hasn't changed really internally. And Professor Dennis De Luca extrapolated the ground floor plan with this tentative suggestion as to what the layout of the palace was like in the time. And you can see almost, it's almost like two separate buildings. The rear part, so the part on Merchant Street, was state property and was acquired by the Grand Master Del Monte, and he had his, eventually he had the magisterial palace was extended there, and eventually subsequent knights such as Grand Master Verdal built a second floor on the Auberge of Italy, the former Auberge of Italy, and after that the armory was built. And it's interesting to see how this is then reflected on the ground. This is another drawing, an engraving of 1650, where you can just barely make out the differences that I've just mentioned. This was after Grandmaster Cardinal Verdal erected his column in Palace Square. It's interesting to read how the considerations for the most basic thing in the city, the provision of water, spared nobody. I mean, everybody had to abide by the rules stipulated by the Ufficio delle Case, which was a body of knights who had some form of architectural and planning background, in which they listed a number of laws, amongst which were considerations for sanitation, drainage, and also water supply. It's interesting to read, though I think this remains to be 100% confirmed, that since much of the land on which the knights built their own buildings belonged to the Shibaras family, the noble Shibaras family, amongst them this building, the Grand Master ceremoniously once a year gave 5 grains of corn and a cup of water from one of the cisterns to the Shibaras family. One cistern was chosen, and an elaborate grill was made in front of the wellhead. I think it's not far from our room here, and this is it today. Unfortunately, the hole is now blocked. And this, in fact, is one of 5 known water reservoirs below the palace. Now, one point of departure when you're doing this research is to go to the sources available and see what drawings one can encounter. The Public Works Department have a number of very interesting drawings showing the foundations of the Magisterial Palace. And what's interesting in these, for example, is that some of the spaces actually had uneven floorings, if you like. And this is something which, as far as I know, doesn't exist anymore. We're talking about drawings dating to the 1850s here. But it's something which I've encountered elsewhere in Valletta. One might imagine that, you know, below every building you would find an equal footprint of cellars and so on. However, I have come across places where only half of the building would have a cellar. The other half would just be rock. So definitely we can omit this myth that no, there has to be some form of a cellar underneath every single space in Valletta. That, I can safely say, is now disproved. And the truth is that, especially with these large buildings, there was a limit to how much they needed all the space below ground. Humidity problems were there. There was enough space to cater for stabling, for storage, for all other activities. And so a number of these spaces were just foundations, which also disproves another theory that the cellars were very low because the people were very short. That's something they just say to tourists. So, you know, what you have here are devices which were intended just to create the required levels. If you go beneath the Archbishop's Palace, for example, you can even see a large vault. The rock is uneven, and there are even a couple of ashlars, a couple of stone blocks, semi-cut out of the rock. And you even find channels in which the intention was to put the metal wedges and extract stone blocks. So all the quarrying that was necessary was carried out, the space was roofed over, and the building built on top. So one has to distinguish between, I suppose, cellars and foundations. And what we're seeing here, in some of the spaces at least, is indications of these foundations. Notwithstanding, over time, such as what happened at the Auberge of Castile, these spaces were leveled out, typically in later Hospitaller times, and more so in the British period, and used for various activities. But the number of drawings I came across is quite limited. No doubt there are more, but in the time I had, I was perhaps more eager to go and see what there really is by accessing all areas which were not blocked off. And this is one of three entrances, if I'm not mistaken, which take you into the underworld. And without any exaggeration, I like to use this term because it's quite surreal. You're down there. Having said that, the subterranean spaces below us are not as deep as one might expect, or one might hope, perhaps. There are a few sections which are quite deep, but most of them are just one story or one and a half stories below street level. So in many times you're walking, listening to people walking about outside, but you're yet in the space which is all dank and musty and so cut off. So I like to use this term underworld, I suppose, because it is a different experience to being above ground. And the immediate sensation is that of disorientation, but not because of where you're standing with respect to upstairs. It's disorientation with what regards the layout of the spaces. And you can immediately see that here there have been lots of alterations. And I am in no position to tell you what was done when both buildings or the four buildings were united. I'm in no position to tell you that is Eustachio del Monte's bit, and that is the Auberge d'Italie's bit. There are areas which I think are clearly the cellars of the Auberge of Italy. You start to notice a pattern. If you go to the present Auberge of Italy, and you go to the Auberge of Castile, and you go to the Auberge of Provence, you'll notice that what you are inside is simply a series of vaults, barrel vaults. Girolamo Cassar applying the same formula, a formula which had been used in Malta for a substantially long time, and the same was applied over here. However, interestingly, below us, the rock is at a very high level. And, that will bring us later on to when we talk about the environs of the palace. So you have all forms of roofing methods in masonry, no timber beams or anything like that. The knights rarely, if ever, use timber beams to roof over the basements for obvious reasons. So the window there is at leg level in Palace Square. And then you start noticing different layers. These compartments, which I suspect are of a much later period, the British period probably. And then hints of vaults suddenly stunted with these concrete slabs. This is very interesting. This is more or less between the two, the Auberge of Italy and the next house, possibly the Bozio's house. Probably this was intended to be an external access, possibly for stabling. The arches are obviously later. It's interesting to see as well that if you look at the plan of Valletta, you will notice that the insula of Valletta, of the palace, excuse me, the road, the street that is Frederick Street, and the street that is Treasury Street, are divided by the palace. Originally, there was an intention to have some form of, if not a through road, an alley over there. And there are indications from old plans and representations of Valletta to support this. One moment you're in a built space, the next you're in a rock-hewn space. And this is something which is so interesting in any underground space, is that you're in an older underground space. In that they, the masons made an effort to try and exploit as much as possible of the living rock. If you really want to appreciate this, when you're driving up Saint Maison and you're stuck in a traffic jam, have a look at the bastion walls just past the Saint Maison gardens, and you'll notice how the knights, through their engineers and through their Maltese, mostly Maltese masons, tried to use the living rock in order to have this what we call negative architecture, where you're sculpting rather than building. And this is something which is very noticeable, particularly, I must say, particularly to the President's Palace. Now, beneath the sides, the flank of the palace that is abutting Archbishop Street, there is a very long vault, which is, when you're inside, this has been cleared since this photo was taken. Once you're inside there, you realize that something's a bit suspicious when it comes to the proportion of this space. And it is clear, after going down the staircase, that this is only half height. That's a concrete slab. Below this, there is a series of spaces which were created in a much later intervention. It's a very long space, not unlike a number of reservoirs which you see in Valletta. It's a barrel vault, and it's waiting to be shown, given some appropriate use, because it is truly a remarkable space. Quite long, but there's a lot of work to be done there. There's another shot. Now, beneath that, again, there is a staircase leading to Archbishop Street, but yet this is blocked off. An intervention which was not done recently, so one, again, starts to understand the... try to understand the reasoning with all of these interventions. And hopefully one would keep these in mind when one is intervening, which I think would be quite a devil of a job to do, because to decide what is going to be historical, what is a bit less historical, or what is given a priority, I think is going to be challenging here. So at the end of one of these vaults, you have this arrangement. Sorry about the slides, but this is 2005 digital photography. Since then, this place is condemned. One can't go in. I'll explain why. Nothing to do with this. What you have here is a central room with these partition walls and a corridor which embraces, if you like, this central space. Built on a huge concrete slab. Beneath that concrete slab, you've got this. So you've got this huge concrete slab supported on stone columns, some of which are supported on these. Yes. Well, telegraph poles, if you like, which have been sliced and inserted. There are a number of theories. The one I subscribe to is that this intervention was carried out to try and mitigate the humidity problem. However, this is a humidity problem which was affecting the building, and possibly these spaces were used for storage. Well, clearly they were used for storage because there's evidence of shelving in there, in order to mitigate this problem. However, time has passed, these have rotted, and a number of these piers, for some reason, were built on the timber logs, and everything is subsiding. Well, I won't say everything, however, the concrete is subsiding. Now, from the little evidence that there is, this was an intervention carried out just before the Second World War, when some form of secure space for an undisclosed reason was created by splitting this vault. So what you've got here is a quadripartite vault, not unlike the one you see at the Sacra Infermeria, which has been, so you've got to imagine this, double the height. Now, below that, in one particular area, there is something else. And one finds an access to it through a tunnel, seems to have been purpose-made, leading to a spiral staircase. Down 40 or so steps, one enters into what seems to have been originally a cistern, one of the five, not particularly big, but I think the cistern, in this case, the fact that it was a cistern, is a bit less interesting when compared to what it was used for, most likely during the Second World War. And this was a strong room. There is one plan which indicates this as a strong room. Though what was held in here, well, it's interesting that here there are two what appear to be ventilators, which are reachable from within those spaces where we saw the logs earlier. There is a story which I don't know if it's, well, I have never found any historical reference to it, but it is said that during the Second World War, Churchill and Roosevelt had a brief meeting in here. But I very much doubt that Theodore Roosevelt could come down these stairs. This is mentioned in a book. I tried to substantiate this. The only thing I came across were rumors, which I suppose are... Sorry. Oh, sorry. That it was a strong room in which money from the... From the government, yes, across the road was kept during the Second World War. We did find, well, there is this. So the space has been roofed over in very thick concrete here. Yeah? You can get an idea of what this also looks like by going into the cellars of Casa Rocca Piccola. And this is the opening for the ventilators. Nearby, there are a number of very interesting graffiti. A bit of a problem with punctuation there, but still still equally interesting. Now, these pencil marks, there's loads of them. There's two ships. There's what appears to be a Spitfire, some love notes anyway. But they're all drawn on the lime, which... I mean, of in a very, very delicate state of preservation, and I hope something is done about this. At least, they're documented before they're lost forever. There is this drawing, which shows the strong room, and shows the exit there, the Garrigor. So thank you for that. And The aspect that gets a bit more exciting for me is when you see tunnels beneath the facades leading beyond the building. one hotel in Merchant Street advertised, this was in the 1860s, advertised that it had amongst its amenities a tunnel that led directly from its premises to the palace, and one can go directly without needing to wet themselves in the rain. Though I've never come across any hard evidence of this, it's just an advert of the time. This doorway is more or less between the two portals on the facade, the two Pinto portals. And according to my investigations with Malta.com, this tunnel leads into the sewers. So it might have been one of the accesses which furnished the palace with sewerage, though I never got further than that. But it does correspond with this drawing, which comes from the Public Works Department. This is from a beautiful watercolour, one of, I think, about a dozen watercolours showing the sewerage of Valletta. And this was designed by the Royal Engineers, completed during the governorship of Sir Charles Van Strobenzee in the mid-1870s, after lots of procrastination and controversy. And this system of subways is still in use still today, although in quite a lamentable state, I must say, especially in the area that is around the, if you like, the center of Valletta. So what you can see here are these subways, as they're called, and these are passages through which you can, well, I wouldn't say comfortably, but you can, you know, walk with relatively, you know, it's not such a problem, because they were created by the Royal Engineers in order to have separate accesses into each and every building along the streets of the city. These accesses then were improved upon, if you like, by pipes. On top of the pipes, you had these stone slabs. So when you're walking in the system, you wouldn't come in contact with drainage. So to go back, most likely the knights devised the central system, and then the Royal Engineers enlarged them. It's very difficult at this stage to say what came first, as in where does one stop and the other start. And what's interesting about these watercolors as well is that they give also a hint, though not this particular detail, of a number of public reservoirs. This is a very detailed drawing of the sewerage of the palace. It also gives the details of the ground floor. Again, still quite discernible is the stratification, if you like, of the way this building was developed. You can even see a hint of the axiality with Treasury Street and Frederick Street. And this takes us now outside the building. I had to put this in because I'm sorry, this was destroyed during the restoration of the facade of the palace. I was shocked. I was there when it happened. It was this was done by the first pottery of Malta, dates to the 1920s, and that sterile Piazza San George has been put instead. Luckily, Heritage Malta picked up the pieces, and it's I think they managed to piece it together. I mean, like it or not, a lot of us still refer to Piazza San George as Palace Square. There are even references dating to the times of the knights where they refer to it as the Piazza del Palazzo. And I've mentioned this before, even Strada Reale, Strada Reale is a name which was used in the knights period. Reale meaning main, and Porta Reale as well. Fort Manuel had a Porta Reale, Fort Ricazzoli had a Porta Reale. In Valletta, Porta San Giorgio was Porta Reale, nothing to do with British royalty. So, that's a bit of a rant. I want to take some time, just a little time before I conclude, to talk about Palace Square as well, because the nice thing about this subject is that you don't look at something in isolation. There are links to the outside. And it was very exciting when the magnificent rehabilitation of Palace Square was carried out a few years ago. A number of very interesting discoveries were made. I think some of them have yet to be revealed. Some very interesting discoveries, which, as far as I know, regard time before Valletta. So one is waiting quite excitingly for that. But what's interesting is there was this artist called Schellings, who made a number of very interesting depictions of Malta, but very few of inside Valletta. This is one of two, if I'm not mistaken. And it shows the Winyakuri fountain with its two basins and the fleur-de-lis. It also shows the discontinuity, if you like, between the Borgia house and the Del Monte house and the Auberge of Italy, which was then much lower. And I put this here mainly to highlight the fountain. The fountain, as you know, was built ceremoniously to commemorate the procurement of water to Valletta after much debate, much proposals, and in quite the nights where Grandmaster Winyakurt had inherited, if you like, the problem from his predecessor, and eventually threw money at the problem and sponsored a good portion of the project himself. And the whole subject of the Winyakurt Aqueduct is very interesting. It's a subject which remains to still be very much researched. One can see how desperate, if you like, the hospitalers were to bring water into the city by the very weak design, if you like, of the aqueduct, very easy to sabotage. However, it was done, and it was seen as quite a feat of engineering. However, in order to store the water, there were these large interventions carried out within the city. Amongst them were the excavation of huge reservoirs. So this is beyond Laparelli and Girolamo Cassari's time. We're talking about the beginning of the 17th century. One would have expected there to be a large reservoir beneath Palace Square. However, for some reason, that never materialized. There was, however, a space which was meant to be the, if you like, the switch room of the fountain. The knights appointed one of their brethren to be the fontaniere, and it was his job from the beginning of the first years of Valletta right until the end, and even during the French interlude, one of the few. It's interesting to read that the French actually kept the fontaniere, who was a French knight, still in that capacity. And his job was to go around inspecting the fountains, drawing up reports. A number of these reports still exist at the National Library. There's a very interesting one, beautifully illustrated by Ponce, in which he actually draws out the lead pipeware of the Magisterial Palace. And his job was also, with, I would imagine, a team of men, to switch off and on the fountains every morning and evening. One of the main reservoirs, which unfortunately was destroyed in the 60s with the construction of City Gate, and more so Freedom Square, was the Winyakurt Reservoir. A very large reservoir, situated on top of the railway tunnel through which all the water came in from the aqueduct below the ditch into this reservoir. From there, it was diverted to all the important buildings and public fountains of the city. I have, this perhaps is not really related, but I have my doubts as to how much of the fountain which now exists at St. Philip's Garden was in fact this fountain. A number of depictions of the Wynyakwr fountain show it to be of a very different profile. And Schellings was somebody who is referred to for his detail. Clearly the subject of this drawing was the fountain. So comparing this to the beautiful fountain that there is at St. Philip's, which even has three bowls, not two, one begins to scratch his head a bit. I'd like to thrash away another theory or whatever, another idea, that the British did away with the fountain. It was not the British. Well, according to this and another drawing I've come across, this is 1795 with the Cocania, but no fountain. So where this idea came from, that it was the British who did away with the fountain in order to give the main guard its use as a parade ground, I think needs to be revised. And here you've got clearly this representation of Palace Square without, okay, the Verdal column, which had vanished long before that, and the Wynyakwr fountain. You know that one of the first constructions of the British in Valletta was the main guard portico. Now this is back in, those railings aren't there anymore. No. I actually had spent a long time looking into this hole with my torch, trying to see what there is. couldn't get any further. This doorway is quite interesting. The arch is one of those arches which clearly dates to the first years of Valletta. The St. John's nave kind of arch, I like to say. If you look at St. John's, the nave is ever so slightly pointed. And this arch is like that, with deep voussoirs. And clearly this is something which dates to the early years of the city, possibly, well, I would say now almost certainly to Wynyakwr's time. And what was this for? As you might recall, the famous discovery, I would prefer to say rediscovery, of the tunnels beneath Palace Square appears something like this. Got this tunnel. The stones, I don't think I've got a photograph here, the stones are all marked with what we call mason marks, which, if I'm not mistaken, Perit Claude Bourge managed to correspond with the mason marks on the aqueduct. If you're ever idling around the aqueduct, preferably when the sun is at an angle, you will notice that every stone has a mark. Some of them are X's, some of them are stars, if I'm not mistaken. They are mason marks. They're a very early form of quantity surveying. So Charlie, who's illiterate, in order to get paid for every stone that he dresses, marks with an X. Berto marks with a figure of eight, or things like that. This is a very interesting subject. Dr. Stephen Spiteri carried out a study of these. They appear on buildings dating to the Knights period and also the British period. I remember seeing them at St. Edward's College. It's interesting to see them at Fort Tignier. Salf, you've seen them. Fort Tignier, I would say almost every stone has a mason mark. And Dr. Spiteri believes that it reflects the financial situation of the order at the time. So in a nutshell, the masons knew that the knights were a bit hard up, so in order to make sure they get paid for every stone, this was done with a bit more fervor. And there are about a dozen different kinds of mason marks at Fort Tignier. The bishop's palace is full of them. Okay, there you go. That's, anyway, it's something which here is very evident. Now this tunnel then diverts into two separate trajectories, one of them heading towards the main god, which is blocked off. Then you come out into this space, which is more or less below the center of the square. And this seems to be the place where the fontaniere would come in without much discomfort, just walk down Bishop Street into the doorway and carry out his inspections. And what's super is that the keys are still there, as are the lead pipes. There is also another key which was lying on the ground there. In the opposite direction to the main guard is another tunnel going straight 90 degrees towards us, towards the palace. Blocked off also. Were they intended again for water supply? Did they have a dual purpose? I won't suggest anything. You know, the interesting thing about this subject is that one leaves certain questions, you know, so far unanswered. But Valletta Rehabilitation Project carried out some research and they found, as far as I know, I stand to be corrected, at least last I spoke to them, they found almost no documentation about these tunnels. If you were thinking that those spaces were quite big, they're not at all. They're exceedingly functional. However, interestingly still, there is no cistern. So, obviously, an underground car park in Valletta, in Palace Square, I would hope is out of the question. These are very, very interesting spaces. I mean, if you're walking around the city, have a look sometimes at the buildings. To be honest, I find that the less ornate the buildings are, the more interesting, because the older they are. There are some buildings which I feel are being mutilated by individuals adding decoration just because there's no decoration, which is destroying the idea of a citta umilissima. The early buildings of Valletta were plain, were simple. They might have had a melitan molding, they might have had a cornice, very simple. And if you walk down, especially in the lower parts of Valletta, towards the bottom of Old Bakery Street, there are a number of even palaces which have very simple melitan moldings. And then you're like, but how come they've got a molding around the window and no cornice on top? Because that was the zeitgeist. That was the in my opinion, that encapsulates the hurry which the knights had and the let's get on with it. Let's not spend money on. Of course, the Baroque period had its great signature on our city. And though there were some, if you like, survivors of this Renaissance mannerist architecture, which I think that I just noticed, I parked on St. Barbara Bastions, that the last building there, which was two stories, very simple, very much as one would have seen it in those very early depictions of Valletta, has now had about four stories built on top, three stories built on top, with cornices and all of this. And I think that is very dangerous. The simpler the building is, very often, the older it is. And this doesn't go only for buildings in Valletta. Anybody wanting more information, my point of reference was, as I said, Dr. Giovanni Bonello's article, Judge Giovanni Bonello's article, in the book, The Palace of the Grand Masters by Fondazione Patrimonio Malta. As far as I know, that is so far the definitive book on the history of this building, though it doesn't cover every aspect, far from it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Edward. Now, if there are any questions, but before, may I pass some remarks as regards the undergrounds? Now I go to the poverty of it. The Maltese builder was simply in love with the Malta stone. It is an interesting aspect about the cutting of the stone down there. Many times it was for economical reasons, not to transport, of course, from far away from quarries, bring the stone. It was much, much more cheaper to cut the stone from there. But the idea also that the Maltese builder loved so much the Malta stone that there were some sayings which for us appear to be funny. But the way they thought about the stone sort of gave them an anima, a soul. Why is it? Because they used to say, you may cut the stone, the locality, the place is offended, but not to be offended too much, they will forgive you if you, when you cut it, you leave it in the same place. But this was the idea of the old builders. Eh? Another point, which is perhaps, I don't know if you know it, Edward, is that the Maltese builder was so much ingrained into the love of the stone that all Maltese builders had a piece of land. They had a garden or a field where they grew the plants. And so there was this great connection with Mother Nature and also the trade, the builder, which, of course, Mother Nature, also the stone. Eh? But there was this great interest. When I spoke, told this to Italian architects, they were amazed. They said they'd never heard of it. But this is one of the points, that there was this great respect for the boss. And another point is that, which unfortunately today is not the case, that nothing was thrown away. Nothing was thrown away. Everything was used, utilized, whether for this or for that thing, nothing was thrown away. So when they dug down the road, there were various also reasons why you cut it. First of all, it's the cheapness. In fact, even the bastions that were there, you see, the stone that they cut, they built with the same stone they built. Not the economy also came into the picture. Then I didn't want to bring from far away quarries to build these huge. Let's not forget the whole bastions of Valletta. You don't believe it, eh? It took only 6 years to build. In 6 years, all Valletta was ready, the surrounding. But apart from that, now there was also another point about humidity, which Edward said, the idea was those wooden logs that they played to learn. But the humidity, they thought that if you can, you lessen humidity. And it was a bad idea when they, especially in Strada Reale and Kingsway, and it's Republic Street, they decided to block it. The humidity goes, you know, by capillarity 14 feet, and it went up when they closed. Why is it? Because the idea was to create ventilation below the house all the time, in the courtyard, and going out also from the front. Eh? This was another point. And another point about Reale is that at the time, yes, it was Strada Reale, Strada San Giorgio, but the people knew it as Strada Reale. Why is it? Even Porta Reale, the king, monarchy, doesn't come into the picture. Why? Because in all our villages, if you remember, if you see the old plans, today it's called simply Main Road. Even in Maltese, Tri Reale, the Royal Road. Why is it? For kings, for the Grand Master, for... No. Royal Road, because Maltese were deeply devoted, they were Catholic, they made processions, and that was the road where our Lord, through the Holy Spirit, had to pass. So it was, for in the people's mind, the Royal Road, the road where Jesus, as Catholics believe, had to pass through. So that was why even Royal Opera House was not for the Queen, Queen Victoria, because it was Royal Road, because it was Porta Reale. This was already, but it was in the people's mind. And the maps, they put it down just the same. Eh? So there was perhaps this misconception about royalty, because our villages all had Strada Reale. But it was for this simple idea, devotional idea. Now, but there are many other aspects, of course, about there was the well down there. Of course, poor slaves were kept there, and many other things. And let's not forget the last point, because I go off at tangent, that at the time of the knights, refuse was collected twice a day. Twice a day, not even once, twice a day, morning and evening. Of course, there were slaves and servants, and there was a place as well. And the nights were, in the whole of Europe, were very, very, very sanitary aware. The awareness was so about health and this, and about the supply of water. And another point, I am convinced that the beautiful fountain that is in Giardino San Filippo Ponce in Filippo, definitely it was there. So who took it away? But it was there because all designs show that it is, and it's so beautiful. And it's unfortunately it's falling to pieces. That I am sure that nobody is going to spend such. I am from Floriana, so I know such a big amount of money to put it just there where nobody can see it. So definitely it was there in the Piazza San Giorgio, as you know, your Palace Square, what is it? Okay, there are a lot of things, but it better stop there. If you have any questions, please. It seems it's a press. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta entitled The Palace Undergrounds. This talk was delivered by architect Edward Side.